Well, I wanted to do a couple different things today. So there's the danger of, instead of doing one thing well, I'll do several things poorly. But I wanted to talk about my understanding of essentially where we are in our understanding, our ability to calculate precisely physically interesting things in involving the real-time response of mostly high-temperature quantum field theories. So I have to say right up front that I'm going to do my best to talk about a whole variety of topics, some of which I've been involved in, a lot of which I've not been involved in. Inevitably, this is going to be a biased selection, biased by that work I know best. I'm hoping that while I'm here, I'll learn about other things that should have been on this list, but that I wasn't sufficiently familiar with. I'm going to be focusing on weakly coupled theories, in principle arbitrarily weakly coupled, so I'm not going to concern myself in the slightest of how much of what I'm talking about is applicable to very complicated situations like, say, heavy ion collisions. I mean, my approach is essentially you learn textbook quantum field theory, and if somebody says calculate the leading behavior at arbitrarily weak coupling of whatever, some simple scattering amplitude, normally you take a back of an envelope, you draw one little diagram, and you write down the answer, and it's really easy. In high temperature theories, if we're talking about equilibrium properties, it's almost as easy, right? We know a lot about equilibrium high temperature quantum field theory. You write some Euclidean functional representation, Euclidean times periodic, you do whatever is appropriate. Perturbation theory, if it's a non-perturbative quantity, numerical simulations, but we have a nice framework in which to think about it. Renormalization group works perfectly nicely for Euclidean field theories. It gives you a whole tower of effective theories if you're interested in longer and longer distance scales. And that's fairly well known for equilibrium quantities. And in essence, the question at hand is how much of any of this theoretical framework is useful if you want to think about real-time properties. So here's a list of some of the things I want to talk about. I want to focus on what's been calculated, what's not been calculated, but we essentially know what will be involved in doing the calculation, and what are we completely confused about. Okay. So let me start with the easiest thing. So pick some, your favorite quantum field theory. I'll mostly consider two different cases, the simplest scalar theory, no gauge interactions, no complications, but a quartic self-coupling, and non-abelian gauge theory, because that's interesting for lots of different reasons. Look at the theory of high temperature. Take a box of it. Kick it. Ask what sort of excitations do you see? That's essentially asking what is the quasi-particle spectrum. In a scalar theory, it's been known for ages, so I don't even know who to attribute this to, that there are quasi-particles which are essentially just dressed-up elementary particles, and the most important thing that happens is they get a correction to their mass. At high temperature, the thermal mass is dominated by that thermal correction. It goes like the quartic self-coupling, lambda, well, mass squared is lambda t squared times a easily calculable known number that just involves evaluating that diagram at high temperature. Easy. A little more trouble is to say if you have one of these quasi-particles propagating along in this what amounts to high temperature soup of other relativistic particles, how long does it last? That is, what is its lifetime. If you inject a particle of some precisely defined momentum, and you then measure the likelihood to find that particle of exactly the same momentum at some time later, how rapidly does it decay? That involves finding the imaginary part of the position of its pole. Ultimately, it involves calculating the imaginary part of this diagram, where now you really have to put this particle essentially on shell, coming in and out. And what do you find? Well, first of all, it depends on whether you're focusing your attention on a typical particle at very high temperature, because typical particles are highly relativistic. Right? The typical kinetic energy will be the temperature. If the temperature is large, then T is large compared to the quasi-particle mass if the theory is weakly coupled. So almost all the excitations are highly relativistic. They have momentum of order of the temperature. And their decay width, decay rate, is lambda squared T. In other words, they live a long time. If you focus your attention on the rare particles that are moving slowly, that is, their momentum is comparable to their mass, then their lifetime goes like lambda to 3/2. All right? That's just a in either case, the imaginary part of the self-energy is order lambda squared. The difference is just the result of doing the exercise of saying, how does that compare to the real part of the self-energy? Okay, so that's easy. That's been known forever. I don't even know who to attribute it to. If you ask the same sort of questions in gauge theories, there's been a much more torturous history. Well, the first part is easy. Now take a box of hot gauge theory. We've got a bunch of relativistic, call them gluons. If you want, put in matter fields, call them quarks, running around in this box. Go through the same exercise of calculating the thermal correction to the self-energy, and you discover, for example, that plasmons, quantized plasma oscillations, acquire an effective mass, which just goes like the coupling squared, that is alpha times temperature squared, times a known, easily calculable number. And that's been known for ages. That's essentially evaluating this diagram and the other one-loop diagrams at high temperature. And so that's giving you the plasma frequency. That's all it's giving you, the plasma frequency in a high-temperature relativistic theory. Much trickier is to ask, if I inject a plasmon, that is, if I set up this plasma oscillation, how long does it last? If you try and do exactly the same thing that was done up there, namely just evaluate the imaginary part of the first diagrams that have an imaginary part, when you put the external lines on shell, which is just these one-loop diagrams, you get answers which don't agree. If you compare the calculation in different gauges. There was a long, torturous history when people realized that depending on what gauge you're working in, what class of diagrams you have to include can differ. But the bottom line is, if you do it right, you get the right answer, which goes like alpha times the temperature, alpha because it's really coming from essentially one-loop physics, a coefficient that just depends on what your gauge group is. That's just a quadratic Casimir. But there's a logarithm. And the logarithm is really telling you that the processes that are destroying this excitation can involve some wide range of scales. Right? They're coming from collisions of this excitation off other particles in this plasma. The momenta transfer, when you have a gauge theory, you can have, you know, arbitrarily low momentum transfer collisions, or you can have high momentum transfer collisions. And for this quantity, you find that you get a logarithm that comes from integrating over momentum transfers from the plasma frequency on down. And the tricky thing is, if you just do this calculation in perturbation theory, there's no lower limit, and that really is just log of infinity. But in a non-abelian gauge theory, we know that there's non-perturbative physics that sets in characteristically at momenta of order g squared t. And one can argue fairly convincingly in a non-abelian theory that this logarithm really is a logarithm of the plasma frequency divided by some number times g squared t. What the right number is inside the logarithm is non-perturbative and is unknown. All right, and this is a distillation of contributions from lots of different people, only a few of which I've listed there. We're going to see, and I'm going to spend some time talking about logarithms that appear in essentially any interesting quantity that you look at in a non-abelian gauge theory. It's a characteristic feature, and it's both interesting physics, and it makes doing calculations harder. All right, for almost this whole talk, I want to try very hard to spend almost all my time talking about sensible physical things. I don't want to talk about gauge variant correlation functions. I don't want to talk about some things that may even be physical in a technical sense, but I can't really imagine how one could ever, even in principle, design an experiment that would measure them, which means, frankly, I shouldn't even be talking about this. In an abelian plasma, there really are plasma waves. You really can talk about calculating their dispersion relation, and that is unquestionably physical. In a non-abelian theory, a plasmon is a colored thing. And there's no reason to think that it really makes sense to talk about an experiment in which you create a plasmon and you watch its excitation over an arbitrarily long time. It's colored at long distance, at long times. You're going to get into the whole physics of, call it confinement, call it color screening, however you want. In essence, the answer is always going to depend on exactly how you tried to make the question you were asking well posed. The interesting thing is, if you will, that ambiguity doesn't show up for affecting the coefficient of this leading logarithm. But it surely does show up at trying to say what's the right number in here. Namely, there can't be a unique answer. It depends on what you mean. Okay. So there's been a huge amount of work talking about calculating self-energy corrections to gluons, to quarks at high temperature, talking about the plasma damping rate. Here I happen to show it for momentum of order t, that is plasmons moving fast. You can also calculate it for plasmons moving slowly. You can do it for quarks. And I'm going to skip all of that because I can't imagine ever designing an experiment that would measure such a thing, even from a theorist's perspective. Okay, well, what is physical? Ultimately, we have a box of hot soup. If you kick it, it acts like a fluid. I mean, it's a bunch of particles rattling around, bouncing off each other. First and foremost, it's a fluid. So anything you can imagine asking that involves the behavior of fluids is fair game. Which leads us into talking about transport coefficients. So the simplest possible fluid has excitations, has disturbances, which live an arbitrarily long time. And asking about the property of excitations that live an arbitrarily long time is essentially asking about what are the hydrodynamic modes of that theory, and what are the transport coefficients that describe their response. Now, if I have a theory with a bunch of particles bouncing around on some characteristic time scale, that is a microscopic time scale, on the face of it, you should be surprised if any excitations can live arbitrarily long times. If everything can just bounce around, if there's some characteristic mean free time for scattering, if that's the typical relaxation for anything happening, you should be surprised if there's any interesting physics on timescales arbitrarily long compared to that. There is in any fluid, because there are conserved quantities. The fact that in a relativistic theory, the energy momentum tensor is conserved, right? That saying that energy density and momentum density are, well, time components of conserved currents. And that, as I'll talk about a little bit later, automatically tells you that a fluctuation in which you disturb, say, the energy density or the momentum density away from its equilibrium value can't just instantaneously, that is, on the time scale of a mean-free, a typical particle mean-free time, can't disappear. Rather, the only way you can get rid of, say, some excess of energy density over some region is to physically transport it over some distance comparable to the size of that region. And the larger that region is, the longer that's going to take. Therefore, automatically, there's going to be arbitrarily long-lived, long-wavelength excitations. So, more technically, how does this show up? Well, the easiest way to describe is to just jump to a phenomenological description. I can talk about hydrodynamic excitations. In particular, I can talk about very small, so essentially linearized hydrodynamics, by just writing down two things, namely, what are the conservation laws? That is, conservation of, well, T mu nu, conservation of any other conserved currents, depending on what theory I'm looking at. All right, so that relates, say, the time derivative of the energy density to the divergence of the momentum density. The time derivative of the momentum density is then related to the divergence of the stress tensor, that is, the spatial-spatial parts of Tij. And then to get a closed set of phenomenological equations, you need something that tells you what Tij is in terms of the variables that are going to describe these arbitrarily long-lived excitations. Well, those variables are going to be some perturbation in the energy density, and in a neutral fluid, some perturbation in the momentum density. Perturbations in momentum density is exactly the same thing as talking about perturbations in which I have some bulk flow of my fluid. So I could have written this literally as momentum density. Instead, what I mean by V is really the bulk velocity of some patch of fluid. Okay, so from textbooks ages ago, all right, you write a phenomenological description that says, what's the stress tensor? Well, in equilibrium, it's just the pressure on the diagonal and zero everywhere else. Slightly out of equilibrium, it will have corrections which depend on how far out of equilibrium you are. Well, simply having bulk flow doesn't mean I'm out of equilibrium at all. If that velocity was constant, that's a perfectly fine equilibrium state. The only thing that makes it out of equilibrium is if that velocity has a gradient. So you do a gradient expansion, and one of the terms you can write down is something that involves literally the shear in the velocity flow, and you put an unknown coefficient in front of it, and you call that shear viscosity. Okay, what is it? It's a fundamental property. In typical, say, molecular gases, you don't have much chance of ever calculating it from first principles, so you go measure it. But I'm looking at a fundamental weakly coupled field theory. It should be easy to figure out what the leading behavior of some obviously sensible physical quantity is in the limit of arbitrarily weak coupling. Well, it's not quite that easy, but what's known? the shear viscosity in a scalar field theory at high temperature. Dimensionally, it goes like some mass cubed, so automatically it goes like T cubed times some dimensionless function of the coupling, and it goes like T cubed divided by lambda squared times a number in the limit where the temperature is large compared to any other scales, that is large compared to the zero temperature mass of the particles. Okay, so immediately it's weird. It goes like inverse powers of the coupling. That's weird at least until you learn a little bit more about transport coefficients and so on. The weaker the coupling is, that means the easier it is to have a particle that, say, has an unusually large momentum. If lambda is very small, then it's easy for that particle to travel a long distance before it scatters. In other words, it's easy to transfer the momenta that that particle is carrying a long distance. That actually means you have a big viscosity. So it's always misleading. I mean, you're tempted to think about arbitrarily weakly coupled theories as being just slight changes from non-interacting theories. Anytime you're talking about transport coefficients, that will completely lead you astray. Right, the viscosity diverges as the lambda goes to zero. It doesn't go to zero. Okay, like I said, oh, there's a little color coding in the whole set of transparencies I'm going to show you. Numbers that whose precise formula is ugly enough that I don't want to show them to you, but which are known, I'm writing as little green number signs.
That formula holds for t greater than something.
Yes.
That something depends on lambda squared.
Sure. If, let me get this straight in my head. If you looked at a 5-4 theory with some zero temperature physical mass m, then this formula, if I'm not misremembering, holds when temperature is large compared to m divided by lambda. Right? If you're interested in, I mean, there's a whole sequence of ranges of temperature. In fact, the behavior of this scalar viscosity to leading order in coupling is known for every characteristic region. That's in essentially the PhD thesis of my student Sang-Yong Jun. But this is just the simplest case to talk about, the asymptotically high temperature regime. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's the very low temperature regime where this looks just like a non-relativistic theory of a bunch of particles with weak repulsive interactions. Yeah, but for simplicity, I just want to look at the high temperature cases. Okay, that's if it's the simplest possible quantum field theory. If you suddenly switch and say, let's talk about a gauge theory, things get a little bit harder. There was early work on this by people like Gordon Boehm and Chris Pethick. There's a nice paper by Henning Heiselberg where he shows that the shear viscosity in a gauge theory, well, he does more than show. He calculates the leading behavior in the sense of what I wrote here. Namely, again, it goes like T cubed. Again, it depends inversely on the strength of interactions. That is to say, it goes like 1 over alpha squared up to a logarithm. Again, one of these logarithms that reflect the fact you have scatterings over a wide range of momentum transfer. This logarithm is really a logarithm of essentially T divided by the plasma frequency. So it's really a different sort of logarithm than the one I had on the last page, which was a log of plasma frequency divided by the non-perturbative scale. So what do we know? We know the coefficient in front. Heiselberg essentially also calculated the coefficient inside the log, which on the one hand is impressive, right? It's always much harder to calculate coefficients, you know, leading log is essentially the number in front. The first subleading correction, in a sense, is getting the number inside the log correct. He described very nicely how to do that. I actually believe there's a small mistake in his answer, which is why this is a two-colored little number here. But we essentially know how to do that. However, what I really want to stress is this was based on pretending not merely that the coupling was weak, but that the logarithm of the coupling is large. And in his analysis, he's dropping corrections that are suppressed by 1 over log of alpha. Right? I mean, it's still a very nice analysis that he was able to calculate the number in front as easily as he could. But I want to argue that this is completely unacceptable for any meaningful application. I mean, I already said I'm going to stay away from heavy ion physics, or in other words, physics where the effective coupling is of order 1. But I'd like to claim that the sort of calculations I'm talking about can be of interest in cosmological settings, high-temperature electroweak theory. Well, the strength of the coupling in electroweak theory, I mean, is reasonably small, but it's certainly not so small that neglecting 1 over log of alpha weak is a reasonable approximation. So for any realistic value of the coupling, if you say you're neglecting correction suppressed just by 1 over log of the coupling, you might as well say that you have no idea what the answer is, at least to within factors of 2 or more. So as essentially a theoretical task, this is really unsatisfying. If the coupling is weak, I'm willing to neglect correction suppressed by power of the coupling, but we really ought to see if we can't calculate something like a transport coefficient correct to all powers of 1 over log of the coupling. And although I don't think I'm going to have time to talk about it in detail, this is a doable task. It doesn't require solving hard conceptual problems. It really just requires solving a slightly ugly but linear integral equation. On the scale of people with big computers, that's a nothing sort of problem. The elegant thing that Heisenberg showed is that to leading log order, that linear integral equation just reduces to a nice local differential operator that you can solve analytically. So that's what's been done. But frankly, somebody should just go ahead and do the whole linear integral equation.
The logarithm in which case is a Coulomb logarithm for spectrum of particles. In other words,
absolutely.
Alpha is the standard denominator of just two particles of spectrum. Are they simply related to that?
Yes, definitely.
There is a simple relation.
For the shear viscosity and for almost all the logs on here, the answer is yes. But the complication is, you know, I mean, it's two particle cross sections vary in phase space, and it's really, you know,
integral.
Hang
on.
Absolutely. Hang on one transparency. Okay. That's the shear viscosity. I'll talk more quickly about other things. So the next obvious thing to do is talk about the bulk viscosity. Again, look at any fluid. Look at corrections to the stress tensor away from equilibrium. This was just looking at the shear and the flow. The other thing you can do is to imagine just having some uniform expansion or compression of the fluid. And there's a term which involves the divergence of the flow velocity times some unknown number, which is called the bulk viscosity. And first of all, let me just skip down here. You'll find in various places the statement that in high-temperature cosmological settings, the bulk viscosity is 0. That's a lie. Even though there's a germ of truth to it, what is true is that if the trace of the stress tensor vanishes, then automatically the bulk viscosity equals 0. And The vanishing of the trace of the stress tensor is, of course, telling you you're in a scale invariant theory. So if we truly had a scale invariant theory, there would be nothing to do. We'd write down bulk viscosity equals zero. High temperature renormalizable theories, that is either lambda phi fourth or high temperature gauge theories, classically are scale invariant. So if you're slightly sloppy, you'll look at it, you'll say your coupling constants are dimensionless, there's no scale that anything depends on, therefore the bulk viscosity equals zero. That's, of course, wrong, because the quantum field theory is not scale invariant. That's where you get running of the coupling, renormalization group, that whole business. And therefore, the bulk viscosity doesn't vanish, but its value inevitably requires having all the same physics that teaches you about running of the coupling. So it's going to be more work. Okay, what's known? In the pure scalar case, it again goes like T cubed multiplied by lambda times a log of lambda. All right, that's to be contrasted with shear viscosity that was T cubed over lambda cubed. So if the theory is weakly coupled, this is enormously smaller compared to that. True enough. Calculating the number is a whole lot harder than calculating the number for the shear viscosity, but Sang-Yong Jun did it. It's a whole lot harder because, as I may talk about in a moment, when you roll your sleeves up and ask what does it take to determine this number, the shear viscosity really is dominantly sensitive to typical excitations in the system, that is, particles running around with momentum of order T. The bulk viscosity isn't. It's dominantly sensitive, to the exceptional particles that are moving very slowly. That's just part of the fact that the particles which are moving ultra-relativistically are acting as if they're in a scale invariant theory, and so they don't contribute. So you have to be much more careful and essentially know that you're treating excitations, exceptional excitations that are moving very slowly, correctly. All right? And again, there's logarithms which says it's really not dominated by any single scale. It receives comparable contributions from particles that are moving arbitrarily slowly up to scale of the temperature. As in any discussion of cosmology, what is your level of accuracy? The cosmological fluid has a non-zero bulk viscosity. That is an absolutely true statement. Whether omitting it is going to significantly change any of your interesting conclusions, probably not. But it certainly depends on what regime.
I'm talking about local synthesis, very basic.
Mm-hmm.
That depends on what the rate of state and the expansion. Now, if you're saying that the bulk viscosity is an important component, then you have different that the rate of the reactions.
I can't give you a crisp answer about how big an error you're making in nucleosynthesis predictions. Well, getting slightly ahead of me. I just told you that in pure lambda phi 4, the number in front is known. Anything for real cosmology, you need more than that. In gauge theories, what do we know? Essentially nothing. Really mean that. Right? The easy part, it goes like T cubed times some function of the coupling. We don't even know what power of the coupling goes in front at the moment, mostly because nobody's thought seriously about it. I mean, getting the power straight surely shouldn't be all that hard. But I don't know what power goes there. I don't know what power of logarithms go there. I certainly don't know what number goes in front. Nobody's worked on it. Good. Okay, so, I mean, I want to highlight things that we don't know, but just because nobody sat down and thought sufficiently seriously about it, this is surely one of those things. There's no good excuse for that. I mean, people could have thought about all this physics 20 years ago. And should have. Okay, what else? Well, several things. Easy. Real, honest to God, electric conductivity. All right, take a soup that might be a real primordial plasma. I really have ordinary electric charged particles running around. Relevant for various discussions is what's the actual electrodynamic response. Well, it's a plasma. It's a conducting plasma. So the electric current should be proportional to some applied electric field, at least for small applied fields. The coefficient is electric conductivity. What is it? Well, again, dimensionally it goes like T, and now it's divided by alpha log alpha, with numbers in front and numbers inside the log, and again with corrections only suppressed by 1 over log of the coupling. Work by Bain and Heisenberg has again shown us how to calculate the leading number in front, but we don't know anything about the number inside the log or further subleading corrections, but subleading only by a power of 1 over log of the coupling. So we don't really know what it is. Absolutely. Yeah, so I could always write this number as 1 and then, you know, just separate it. I'm just always used to putting, so to speak, the first 1 over log correction, writing it as getting the number inside the log correct. No, there I meant real, honest to God QED conductivity. That's something physical. I'll talk about color conductivity in a moment. Okay, another thing which has been looked at is essentially flavor diffusion. There's a whole variance of this. I mean, you can look at fermions of, you know, the left-handed fermions, or you can look at particular flavors. In any case, you're saying, suppose I have some excess or deficit in, you know, what, left-handed top quarks. How does that relax? That's essentially a diffusion problem. So in the same spirit, you write down a diffusion equation. The charge density, where now I mean the charge that's associated with whatever question I'm asking, you know, that's the time component of conserved current. The spatial parts you phenomenologically write as a diffusion constant times the gradient of the charge density. And what do we know? Well, it's exactly the same story. Power of T divided by couplings and logs of couplings, that is alpha squared log alpha. These folks wrote a paper in which they calculated the number in front. Essentially the same set of people wrote a follow-on paper where they calculated the number in front and got a different answer. Peter Arnold and I have been looking at, not only repeating these things, but trying to calculate 1 over log corrections. We've essentially independently done that. We got a third answer yet again. I think we know what the right answer is, but that's on hold. Same story. We don't know the numbers inside the logs or the subleading logarithmic corrections. So that's pretty pathetic. I mean, these are obviously sensible questions, the simplest physical quantities one can think about in some high temperature fundamental field theory, and we barely know anything about them. Okay, as to just a flash of a transparency of what it takes to calculate these things, you have a choice. You can be a masochist or you can be lazy. If you're a masochist, you say that all of these transport coefficients, you go through a standard little exercise involving linear response, which is really just first-order perturbation theory, and you derive a Kubo relation, which relates that transport coefficient to the properties of fluctuations in equilibrium. And in particular, you derive something which says various transport coefficients involve, that, well, one way to write them is something that involves a current-current correlator. I've written this Fourier transformed in both space and time, evaluated in equilibrium, so it should be easy. The tricky thing is you have to evaluate it at a very special point. Namely, first set the spatial momentum to zero. So evaluate this at non-zero frequency, zero spatial momentum, and then essentially calculate the slope at zero frequency. So if, like me, you like to think about calculating anything in equilibrium as first starting in Euclidean space, this really means calculate these correlators for all possible discrete Matsubara frequencies, then analytically continue to real frequency, and then approach what is a very special point, namely zero frequency. And this is a cause of a lot of complication. If we were interested in this correlation at just some generic form momentum, then you just write down the lowest order diagram, which for a current that's bilinear in the fundamental fields would just be a one-loop diagram. You calculate it. It's a back of the envelope. And you'd be done. That's the correct weak coupling approximation for generic values of the form momentum going through. But it's completely useless if what you want to do is take this limit here. And instead, if you want to do this from Feynman diagrams, you find that an infinite class of diagrams contribute, which are all sort of ladder-like diagrams, but where you have to dress the propagators on the, so to speak, side rails, and you have to dress the sort of rungs of the ladder. In the scalar theory, Sang-Yong Jun can tell you exactly what sort of dressings you have to do. It's a mess. And then you really have to take the imaginary part of these diagrams, and which really means summing over all possible ways of cutting them, and you have to sum that all up. And in weak coupling, leading weak coupling limit, you can do that. And you get a linear integral equation, and you can solve it. That's for masochists. Much more efficient approach is to argue that the relevant physics that you're probing is correctly reproduced by writing down a kinetic theory, a Boltzmann equation with a collision term on the right-hand side, calculate essentially the cross-sections of your elementary excitations once, put them into your collision term, and then use that Boltzmann equation to solve for the relaxation of your distribution functions. That literally means linearizing that Boltzmann equation. So then you really get some linearized collision operator on the right-hand side, and any one of these transport coefficients turns into the problem of calculating some particular expectation value of the inverse of that linearized collision operator. That's just another way of saying solving a linear integral equation. And the linear integral equation you get this way is exactly the same as the linear integral equation you get that way, assuming you write down the correct kinetic theory. We know how to do that in detail for calculating either the shear or the bulk viscosity for scalar theory. It's much more subtle to get your kinetic theory accurate enough to do the bulk viscosity. We know how to do that for calculating shear viscosity in gauge theories, and I don't know how to do that for calculating bulk viscosity. Okay. Wow. There's one other quantity that's had a lot of discussion recently specifically for non-abelian gauge theories, which is the topological transition rate, or if you prefer, the rate of baryon violation in a high temperature phase I'll focus on the case of arbitrarily high temperature. This is really just another transport coefficient. It is essentially the diffusion constant for the Chern-Simons number carried by the gauge field. You're essentially saying start with some gauge field configuration. Well, I mean start with some ensemble of gauge field configurations. If you have a given value of the Chern-Simons number at some time, and you wait long enough, you'll have transitions where it increases by one, you'll have transitions where it decreases by one. If you wait arbitrarily long time, it should act like a random walk, and in any essentially one-dimensional random walk, and that means its long-time behavior will be to grow like time up to some coefficient, which is the Chern-Simons diffusion rate. Or if you prefer, the rate of topological transitions. What's known? Well, it's literally a rate per unit volume. So dimensionally, it's going to go like temperature to the fourth. For a long time, it was assumed that it really went like the characteristic momentum scale for equilibrium non-perturbative processes, which is g squared t, or if you will, alpha t, to the fourth. And that's wrong. It doesn't go like alpha to the fourth. It goes like alpha to the fifth. That's something that Peter Arnold Dahm-Sum and I realized a few years ago. There's an extra power of alpha that really comes from the fact that the characteristic time scale for these processes is different than the characteristic size of the relevant fluctuations in space. And there was never any reason they shouldn't have been different, but people simply didn't think about that for a long time. That's essentially due to the physics of, well, I could call it plasma damping, but even more simply, it's simply the physics of Lenz's law that says magnetic fields in a conducting plasma, they're very hard to change. The plasma always responds in a way that will cause it to resist changing a magnetic field. And the relevant fluctuations are precisely non-abelian magnetic field fluctuations. A year ago, Dietrich, wherever he is, pointed out that we were wrong in that it's not just alpha to the fifth, but there's a logarithm as well, which is really a logarithm of the plasmon frequency divided by something non-perturbative, which turns into a log of some number over alpha. And what do we know? Well, so I believe, I'm quite convinced that we now have the correct form of the answer. That was challenging enough in its own right. And moreover, we now have, thanks to Guy Moore, reasonable information on the number in front. This is a completely non-perturbative number. It requires doing some sort of numerical calculation. What's really quite nice, though, is that to get just this number in front, Dietrich argued, it is sufficient to look at a very simple, effective theory describing long wavelength, low frequency magnetic fluctuations. Namely, write down phenomenological, if you will, non-abelian Maxwell's equations. D cross B equals, well, normally there's an E dot term, and then there's a current term, but this is a conducting plasma, so the current is some sort of conductivity times the electric field. That turns out to be much more important than the E dot term. And add some noise, which is physically reflecting the coupling of these low frequency degrees of freedom on all the typical high frequency particles running around. So, as we'll hear more about, and I won't talk about now, one can argue that a diffusive Langevin equation of this form is sufficient for calculating the leading logarithmic behavior of the topological transition rate, and it's been done. And, well, what do you need? First of all, you need to know the value of this color conductivity. And again, it will be argued that that's something which, to leading logarithmic order, you can calculate. In fact, we know what the answer is. A known number times t divided by a log, up to correction suppressed by just powers of 1 over log. So that's a lot of progress in the last year, which I at least hope we'll have a lot more discussion of. I should emphasize that my own little rule for this talk of only talking about things that are physical, I need to very clearly distinguish. This is something physical. This surely is not. There is no Kubo formula for evaluating a color conductivity in terms of some equilibrium correlation function of well-defined, that is, gauge invariant operators. Nevertheless, one can argue that this makes sense to leading logarithmic order. I have very grave doubts that it even makes sense to talk about really calculating this to all orders in 1 over log. And yet this is something physical. So it's one of these things where you're calculating something that was really going to be scheme dependent simply as some input into what will also have to be a scheme-dependent equation if you wanted to do subleading corrections in such a way that all the scheme dependents would cancel out. But that's something we don't know how to do today. That's an important problem.
Yes. The alpha depends on temperature.
Yes. Yes.
So it is, you have about 5.4.
Yes. Right. And every, I mean, in every place I've written alpha, it really is alpha at the scale of T. Yeah.
Elaborating on that, couldn't you just redefine alpha and say 1 over log is like alpha, so log is like 1 over alpha, different kind of alpha, and that's the sort of alpha to the fifth, log alpha into an alpha to the fourth, with a special alpha?
I can't stop you from doing that. But the logs that are affecting the running of alpha, as you know well, is really coming from high momentum physics. Physically, this is a very different log. I mean, this really is log of a Debye mass over non-perturbative scale. So, I mean, mathematically, there's nothing wrong with what you said, but I would feel that that's sort of misleading one about how to think about the physics.
Well, it's probably difficult to pin down the scale. Mm-hmm.
That's fine. I mean, like I said, it's been a slightly torturous path to make it to this formula. If I was giving this talk one year and a few days ago, I wouldn't have known of Beatrice's work. I would have claimed that there was no reason to think there was a log there, and it really was alpha to the fifth, such is life. Okay. What's our plan here? Should we take a break or should I just keep going? This is not a terrible place for a break.
Maybe it should be. Is it roughly halfway?
Yeah.
Try to take it only a 10-minute break.
Okay. Okay. First of all, let me just mention that this afternoon's schedule is a little different than originally posted. It will be some combination of Dietrich Boedeker and Dam Sun talking about stuff related to the topological transition rate. And that will start
at one.
Secondly, let me just comment just to fess up. Jan, you allowed me to swindle myself. Alphas are running couplings which vary with temperature, like log of t, 1 over log of t. This log is a log of a coupling.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
it's a log of a log of a t. I mean, this log can't cancel the running of the coupling.
The ambiguity in the energy momentum sense, does it play any role in the transport coefficient? I mean, you have so many energy momentum senses you can define that have a certain class.
In the pure scalar case, no. Which I think means simply no, period. Physically, it has to be true. But I can't say that I'm prepared to go show you a formal proof.
How do you define the S-term? You can define the S-term in different ways. You can say that the other currents, like the baryonic currents or whatever, are zero, or you can say that the momentum is also zero.
It depends. First of all, if you have a pure Phi-4 theory, where team you knew is the only set of conserved currents, then you don't have that ambiguity. Then the only obvious choice is to say the frame in which the momentum density vanishes. You only get these, not ambiguities, you only get this freedom to make different choices when you have an additional conserved current, like conserved baryon number, which is the case of real fluids. In which case, you're free to work, you know, in the frame where your baryon flux vanishes, or you're free to work in the frame where the momentum density vanishes. I mean, one's the Landau and Lipschitz convention, the other is
Eckhart,
thank you. It doesn't affect what you mean by a transport coefficient. It simply gives you a different way of writing a correct formula for calculating it. Everything I wrote down tacitly assumed the Landau-Lipschitz convention.
Which one is related to experiment? I mean, when you measure this coefficient.
I mean, in typical non-relativistic fluids, I mean, in some sense, one can argue that the Eckhart convention is the most natural. I mean, that's the frame in which the center of mass is at rest. And you can still have an energy flux. And that's why thermal conductivity is an independent transport coefficient, which wasn't on the list I showed before. But, I mean, it's a matter of convention. You're free to talk about it in whichever frame you want. Okay, so far, all the examples I talked about were cases of real-time response when you're only slightly away from equilibrium. That's what typical transport coefficients are giving you information about. I want to turn now to a brief discussion of a problem we're going to be hearing a whole lot more about, namely inflationary reheating. This is a wonderful problem simply because it's a case of looking at relaxation starting from a situation that's far from equilibrium, but simple. It's just what theorists love. So I'm assuming everybody has heard something about this. If not, you're going to hear more. But take your typical inflationary model, which I'll pretend is just a single scalar field. You've got some potential for this field. And just arbitrarily imagine that you're starting with some homogeneous expectation value of the field, constant in space, nowhere near the minimum of the potential. And all you're doing is asking what happens. Now, the motivation for this, of course, comes from real inflationary cosmology. I'm going to completely ignore that. In fact, I'm going to completely ignore curve space and expansion of the universe, simply because if we don't have good control for how to answer this problem in the case of just Minkowski space, then at least personally, I'm not going to spend too much time asking what happens in curve space. So the wonderful thing is we have this very simple initial condition labeled by just one number. What's the initial expectation value of the field? Everything's homogeneous initially, and the question is what happens. So qualitatively, you're right. Exactly. And so let me make exactly what you said. Assume I'm in a simple Gaussian coherent state. Okay, what happens? Classically, you roll back and forth. Quantum mechanically, as you start rolling, you can produce particles. That particle production is transferring energy from the condensate, that is the homogeneous inflaton, into ordinary particle degrees of freedom. Excitations running around with some non-zero momentum. So, as the thing sloshes back and forth, if you wait, what do you expect to happen? Well, if I ignore expansion of the universe, energy is conserved. Total energy initially is all in the condensate with no energy in ordinary particles whatsoever. If you wait, you should see this energy fall to zero, this energy go up, and we should end up with some hot system that's in equilibrium. That is, that's rethermalized, all the energy has been distributed however it wants to in order to reach an equilibrium state. There's lots of things one can ask about this. We've already seen in Emil's talk various pictures of trying to show the actual evolution of the condensate as a function of time. It wiggles, its envelope decays. I shouldn't have said just Emil's talk in several talks. Just to simplify my discussion, I'm going to focus on one particular quantity, which to me seems like the most obvious thing to put your attention on, namely, how long does it take to move half the energy from the condensate into particles? Right? That's just a crude answer of what's the characteristic time for the system to relax. All right? So there's some answer to that question. Good, and that's why I gave you a particular question I am choosing to ask. All right, what's the time for half the energy to move? I could have picked, 10%, I could have picked 90%, I could have asked to actually show a real-time history, and I'm just deliberately trying to focus on something that's as simple as possible that captures, that's going to depend on a lot of the complicated physics going on.
Do you want to talk about thermalization? Do you want to talk about inflaton decay?
We're going to be hearing a lot more about this. I'm already showing you my chosen bias for today, which is to really think about relaxation. Sure. Mm-hmm. All right. This particular question is motivated by something I think it's interesting. It's not motivated by what's easy to calculate, not in the slightest. Whatever it is, it's some function of where I start, how strong the coupling in the theory is, the shape of the potential I'm rolling around in, which if I have the simplest possible model really just means it's a function of some mass squared or some curvature. And trivial dimensional analysis lets me write it as something that depends on the initial amplitude times a dimensionless function of dimensionless variables, namely a coupling and a ratio of m squared to phi naught squared. And so I will choose to say the question is, what's this function? What do we know about that function?
In general, the velocity also depends on your initial Gaussian.
Yes.
And so on and so forth. So we must have some assumptions. For example, we have a very narrow initial state
because it's only this.
Well, I certainly, you come on, I mean.
Specify that.
Good, consider it specified.
Because you're in a post-inflationary world, right? So in, if you believe that inflation somehow erases your initial condition, you're in sort of de-inflationary initial state.
Correct.
At this point.
Correct, precisely.
What do you mean by particle? I don't understand the question. Well,
I told you right up front that for this discussion, I'm going to ignore expansion of the universe, right? It's, I'm pretending that we're looking at a small region.
You are already questioning quality particles. It's a difficult concept. What kind of particles?
Well, so, I mean, I have a bunch of energy in a nonlinear interacting quantum theory, right? Eventually, I truly believe I will assume for the purpose of this discussion, and if somebody really wants to question it, I guess we can go down that path, but I will assume that nonlinear interacting quantum field theories are thermodynamic systems. It will eventually equilibrate. And so I can talk about particles in the same way that you could have asked earlier. Well, my definition is, I mean, really just, I don't have to talk about particles at all. All I really have to say is what's the energy of the condensate. By
so
definition,
that
the
expectation value is VLI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
The expectation value of T0 of the zero mode, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, take the expectation value of the field.
Usually
good suggestion. It's not there. Did you have some other question? Or? Okay. So lots of people have worked on this. I will undoubtedly offend somebody, even though I tried to list all the names of papers which I'm aware of that have talked about this. I'm sure the list is much longer. There's no ordering here other than alphabetical. And today, if I say, what do I know about this function? The honest answer is nothing. Which is, again, a pretty dismal state of affairs. Touche. However,
it is model dependent. It depends on the model.
Of course, of course. But again, the context here is assume the theory is weakly coupled. I mean, you know, roll up your sleeves. We're theorists. We should be able to calculate. Here's an interesting thing, and it's received lots of attention, and we're a long way away from being able to answer at least one choice of what's sort of one person's first interesting thing to think about.
Well, we don't know some things, except maybe not for this half-time decay, which nobody really cares about. And that, I guess, the reason we don't know this particular function. But the interesting quantity is like typical variances of fluctuations. We have a fair understanding of that.
Well, for this talk, for better or worse, I am trying to focus on crisply defined, you know, something where you can ask, is it right or is it wrong? Not, do we have a qualitative understanding? Yeah, we have a lot of qualitative understanding. That's a quibble, but if you want me to ask what's happening to those variances at times out here.
Yes. Open the paper and listen.
Like I said, I'm will be delighted to learn of things which I'm not completely familiar with that I should have been. I don't think we know reliably how to do...
T1 half is just how long it takes to transfer the energy out. It's got nothing to do with thermalizing that energy or redistributing it in any way. It's just transferring it out of the condensate, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll be discussing this more. I only want to make a couple of comments on at least portions of, well, some bits of how people have thought about this. This is just trivia. You start low enough, it's easy and it's not interesting. You start far enough up that you're in a non-perturbative domain, well, you're in a non-perturbative domain. We have heard about one of the approaches people have talked about, which is to generalize from a one-field model to n-field, look at the large n limit, because it gives you a, quote, controllable expansion. And it gives you nice pictures like this, where I have wiggles in an envelope. I particularly took the simplest, whether it's the simplest or not, in order to write that, I had in mind the case where I really don't have Goldstone modes. If I do, yes, it goes to zero, but admittedly, as we still heard about and we know, I mean, you still see...
No, I don't agree, but when you, in the envelope, in the
Fine. Consider this crossed out. It's still true that your, quote, large time behavior is short time behavior, physically. It's still absolutely true that, yeah, that the real long time behavior unquestionably depends on rescatterings of all the particles you're producing. I mean, there's no question about that. And all I want to emphasize is we know unquestionably that the mean free times for those particles to rescatter, at least when you've already produced a lot of them, is something that is proportional to n as n becomes large. So we automatically know, you just can't avoid the fact that there is a non-uniformity. And when you say large n is a controlled expansion, what's known how to do, how to calculate, is to pretend that the times you're interested in are fixed and of order one, which just means you're prevented from really looking at what to me, maybe not to Sergey, but to me is some of the most interesting physics. It's clear, well, at least lots of people say the words, that you'd like to do some sort of full quantum treatment for early times and then match to some sort of effective kinetic description which would put in those rescattering effects physically. That has to be right. What I don't know is how to do it in a controlled way. In a weakly coupled theory, at some point, it has to become an adequate approximation. Whether controllable way of doing the matching is exactly what I don't know, and is to me one of the important.
Late time. I guess there's an overall, called confusion, call it what you like. For instance, we were mostly interested in times when fluctuations become the last. So you have the field that decays into some fluctuation, its own or other fields. And we are interested in times when fluctuations are the largest because it is when the defects are produced, when phase transitions happen, et cetera, when the effect is the biggest. And these are not long times apparently in your terminology. So mm-hmm. There is this discrepancy in questions that are being.
I mean, there's a whole variety of interesting physics,
right.
Unquestionably.
Wait.
I'm picking a few things to comment about. There's lots of other interesting things, and there's been a lot of progress made on interesting physics, but at time scales short compared to that. All right. However, if you're interested...
Look, if there are large occupation numbers, the mean photon is greatly shortened by the stimulated, because all these spectrums and decay become stimulated. So you have to put, if you want to point out where you estimate, you have to put some kind of occupation number instead of temperature.
But, I mean...
The system is not even thermal at that stage.
Fair enough, but temperature here is... I mean, an effective temperature that's a measure of the energy density or equivalently the occupations. And so the effect you just said is right there, that this time gets shorter as the effective temperature or the occupation densities go up. It doesn't change the fact that if what your theoretical framework was a large N expansion, you still have this factor of N here causing trouble.
Well, sorry, I didn't get to see what it said.
Okay, so this is a very interesting problem. That's why I wanted to talk about it. It'd be nice if, even though I can't write great answers for you, but since I can't show you answers to that, I want to switch to a very different, but related just in the sense of asking about true long-time relaxation. I'd like to be able to talk about that physics in this context of inflationary reheating because I think it would be interesting. I don't know how to do it. So let me switch to a much simpler topic that will have sensitivity to some of the same ingredients.
Well, let's get this straight. The interesting question that you were referring to is Stignia thermal equilibrium. What do you mean by large time scale?
Well, certainly for the remaining part of this talk, I really mean large time behavior, so it will be the process of thermalization.
Okay.
It will be the real approach to equilibrium. But I now want to talk about it in a much simpler context, much more controlled, where we do have CRISPR answers. And so I want to talk a little bit about... This is now some work that Peter Arnold and I did a year or a year and a half ago or something, which was stimulated by some numerical calculations of Tang and Schmidt. I won't spend a long time on sort of the motivation, the preview. Let me just say, out of nowhere, let me now ask you to consider a non-abelian engaged theory with a scalar field, that is a SU2 Higgs theory, just because it's the simplest theory that has non-abelian gauge interactions and has matter fields. And I could look at lots of things in this theory. The particular thing I'm going to choose is the same thing that Tang and Schmidt chose to look at, which was a nice thing. Namely, there is a conserved current in this theory, other than Tmu nu, and having nothing to do with the fact that this is a local gauge theory. Namely, there's a global conserved current, which is the current that generates the custodial SU2 right, if you will. And one way I can write it is this. Phi is my complex scalar field. And it's simply a global conserved current. Suppose I simply take its average overall of space. That is, I look at the zero momentum component of it. Again, just as a way of focusing on something that's simple. If I now look at small disturbances away from equilibrium, you can ask, how do fluctuations in any quantity relax? And I'm just going to choose this quantity as what I felt like looking at. All right, that relaxation is equivalent to saying, do we know what the real-time correlator of this quantity, current at time t, current at time zero, in thermal equilibrium is, as a function of time. And the interesting thing is to just go through what it takes to think about this for all possible ranges of time, short time behavior, intermediate time, long time, and that's what I'm going to show you in a moment. Now, if you're a little bit naive, you say, first of all, we've already talked a little bit about hydrodynamic fluctuations, about the fact you can have some degrees of freedom that relax arbitrarily slowly. This isn't one of them. This is the space part of a conserved current. The time component of that current is a conserved charge density. If I have a fluctuation in that charge density, that has to relax slowly. But this is the space part I'm choosing to look at. Right? That current, you have, you know, that's the current carried by some little charged particle. It scatters, it changes its direction, that changes its contribution to the current. A couple of scatterings, and this current should be able to relax. So in the usual condensed matter qualitative discussion of I've got slow degrees of freedom, I've got fast degrees of freedom, this is a fast degree of freedom. A priori, you'd expect it to simply do nothing interesting. That is to say, its correlation is biggest at time zero, where you're just measuring the size, literally the RMS fluctuations in this particular observable. And as time increases, you'd expect it to just relax with some characteristic microscopic relaxation time. Well, the question is it right? And the question is, what can you calculate? And, yeah, let me not play games and just put my answer up here. So again, the ground rules are, I'm assuming this theory is arbitrarily weakly coupled. Before I worry about calculating any numbers, the first thing is to just understand the form of the answer. How does it depend on the coupling, what powers, what functional form? And that alone is fairly interesting. So I probably should have said, I'm assuming you all know there's been a vast number of papers on non-equilibrium quantum field theory from formal perspectives, discussions about how to do perturbative calculations, rules for Feynman diagrams, different ways of packaging it. You haven't heard me spend any time talking about it. A lot of people, when they hear the words sort of real-time finite temperature physics, they're automatically thinking about these various rules of real-time propagators and Feynman rules. Well, here's a nice application. Some specific real-time correlation function, start drawing graphs, start calculating, what do you learn? Well, there's some domain in which doing real-time finite temperature perturbation theory is completely fine. And it's certainly fine at time zero when this is really an equilibrium quantity. It's equally fine for sufficiently short times, which here mean times of order 1 over the temperature. And what it will tell you is that initial correlation falls and then flattens out, and there's a plateau. And if I do one-loop perturbation theory, ignore everything to the right of here, and this plateau goes on forever. And if I do two-loop perturbation theory, you get the same thing. That plateau goes on forever, and three-loop and four-loop and 57-loop perturbation theory. And that really shouldn't be a surprise. One can talk about doing this calculation in terms of Feynman diagrams, and that's completely needed and appropriate if you're interested in the shape of this initial transient. For weak coupling. Everything here is assuming coupling is arbitrarily small. Right? But if you say you now understand that and it's not interesting and you want to know what happens beyond it, as I'll talk about in just a second, the efficient way of thinking about what's going on is to realize that in this domain, you're really describing your system as free kinetic theory. You can get that from perturbation theory. There's nothing wrong with it. This is supposed to be the range over which that's useful, but the easiest way is to do free kinetic theory. Once you understand that, it's collisionless. Just, you know, particles move forever. Potentially, except for this quantity, they're not relevant. So this is literally just, you know, free ideal gas. Once you understand that, it's a no-brainer that if you really want to ask how do things relax, you've got to put in the physics of what scatters these particles. So one could, in principle, go back to Feynman diagrams and figure out what's the infinite class of ugly diagrams you'd have to resum to do that. That's very similar to the class of diagrams I sketched when I talked about calculating transport coefficients. Far more efficient, of course, is just say, well, if a kinetic theory description is adequate, let's use a good enough kinetic theory that contains the collisions. If you write down that kinetic theory, if you linearize it, as I'll also show in a moment, you'll get a nice exponential decay. And if this was following the line that you sort of calculate until you get the answer that you expect and then you stop, that would have been a natural stopping point. And we'd calculate an exponential decay rate, and we'd say that's the end of the story. What I really want to talk about is how that's complete garbage. And the true long-time behavior is not exponential, but it's power law, and that's all connected with the fact that there are hydrodynamic excitations, even though the particular quantity I'm talking about looked like it wasn't a hydrodynamic mode. Okay. Oh, as long as it's up here, what do you find? You'll find that the characteristic time scale where the exponential decay sets in, which is the same thing as what the characteristic exponential decay rate is something that depends on coupling like 1 over g to the fourth t times log, where every type place I write log here, it just means log of 1 over the coupling. Even once you know about hydrodynamics and long time tails, you might have thought that you'd see exponential decay for a really long time and somehow it would be a completely different time scale where any of this sort of power law stuff would turn on. In fact, the time scale at which you switch from exponential decay to power law decay is 1 over g to the fourth t. So they differ just by one factor of log of the coupling. So if the coupling is truly incredibly weak, that can be a lot of e-foldings. But, you know, that requires really incredibly weak coupling. And you can also say how big is the correlation when you switch to this hydrodynamic regime, and it's dropped by, well, t cubed compared to g to the 12th t cubed. It's dropped by a lot of powers of g. So it's a pretty small correlation if you were ever to think about actually trying to do a numerical simulation that would see these sort of tails if the coupling is truly weak. Yes. That's a good question. So since I have my picture here, let me just say that. What happens is you crank up the coupling. There'll still be some sort of initial transient where your equilibrium correlations start to fall. And necessarily, there will still be power law hydrodynamic tails. The argument showing that these exist has nothing to do with the strength of the coupling. What happens is you essentially squeeze out this intermediate regime where a kinetic theory description is appropriate. And in fact, you cannot justify a kinetic theory description unless the coupling is weak, right? Because that relies on the separation of time scales. You have to be able to say that the time between collisions, that is a mean free time, is large compared to the time of a collision. And if the coupling was of order 1, both those numbers are of the same order. So in that case, you have a really nasty problem of somehow going straight from strongly interacting quantum field theory, boom, into a hydrodynamic regime. I have no idea how to do that. I certainly can't do it analytically. I don't even know how to do anything numerically. Okay. I really want to talk about the long time behavior, but I'll just briefly start at short times just to emphasize. If you want to do perturbation theory, it's dead easy. The first contribution is a one-loop graph just because we're looking at a composite operator correlator. You calculate it, and you get a square of a propagator, and propagators have a form where they have positive frequency and negative frequency, and obviously if you multiply that out, you get two sort of things. You get terms which wiggle, and from the cross term of these two pieces, you get terms which don't wiggle. In other words, you get a DC value and you get a transient. And that's exactly what gave that behavior I showed on the first graph. So the DC value you can easily calculate. The transient you can also easily calculate. Forget CFT here is not conformal field theory. That's classical field theory, which is a cutoff classical field theory. I wasn't going to talk about it, so just ignore that. In the real quantum field theory, if it's a massless theory, that initial transient is just a pure exponential. You can calculate it. All right, I'll throw that up, but I've already basically said everything that's there. The DC value is something you can most easily understand just by using free kinetic theory. There's lots of ways of saying that a little bit more formally. Just slightly more formal is to write out a mode expansion of the field, plug it into the form for the current, and to just recognize that the terms which don't wiggle are basically just counting the number of excitations, and the terms which do wiggle are essentially quantum interference terms. Okay, so if I now move to longer times and I really want to see the decay of this DC value, it's clear that I have to put in effects of interactions among what are essentially my gas of particles, my gas of charges. And if I can get the transient described correctly with a free kinetic theory, then I surely will get the decay described correctly if I build the correct interacting kinetic theory. Okay, what does it take to really calculate something? Well, in brief, it's a very sketchy form. Well, a little reuse of transparencies. What's the time scale with which the DC value starts to fall off initially exponentially? Well, it depends on scattering, which means it depends on some characteristic mean free time. The only thing you have to be careful about in a gauge theory is, what do you mean by the mean free time? Because we have charged particles, if you ask how often does a particle suffer some collision, well, if it's an arbitrarily small angle scattering, since we have long range interactions, that happens vastly more frequently than if you ask what does it take to have a large angle scattering. So the answer to the question, what's the characteristic time to have any scattering whatsoever, that's what I could call tau small, is completely different from the answer to what's the time scale to have a scattering which changes, say, the direction of the particle by some amount of order one. If I'm interested in the current, it's easy to see which time scale is relevant. Namely, right, the current, my current density operator really is just summing up the contributions to the current of every little charged particle. Its contribution to the current is just its charge, which here I mean is this globally conserved charge, which doesn't change, times its velocity. So if it has a very, very small angle scattering, that makes a negligible change in its contribution to the current, so it doesn't degrade the current. The only thing that will degrade the current and cause it to relax is if I really change the direction of a particle by an amount of order one. So that's what I called tau big. That's the mean free time for a large angle scattering. Or slightly more carefully, it's the mean free time to accomplish an order one change in direction by a whole sequence of much smaller scatterings. Interesting thing about gauge theories in 3 plus 1 dimensions is that those things are equally important. And therefore, I guess I didn't write it there and I probably should have, that mean free time, if it was just a single large angle scattering, then, well, you know, you just look at the lowest order diagram. It's obviously proportional to alpha. You've got two vertices. That's the amplitude. You square it. You get a cross-section that goes like alpha squared. And so if it was a single large angle scattering, this time would be 1 over alpha squared 2. That's not quite right by logarithm, precisely because of this business that you can have a whole sequence of smaller angle scatterings. So there's a logarithm here. All right, that's qualitative. Suppose I really want to get the numbers right. What do you do? Well, you can go back and sum a horrible set of ladder-like Feynman diagrams, or if you're not a masochist, you write down a Boltzmann equation. And for this particular quantity, it's sufficient not really to worry about background fields. Just write down a Boltzmann equation with a collision term and put in the real 2-to-2 particle scattering amplitudes with momenta transfers of, you know, all possible range, and it's hiding there. Yes, and this log here really turns out to be a log of T over the plasma frequency. Yes. And that's what's improved this enough. So in fact, you're not sensitive to arbitrarily low momenta where I'd really get into this issue of scattering off some stochastic background fluctuations. Right. I should have said I write M sub PL just to confuse everybody. It's not the Planck mass, it's the plasma frequency. Okay, so right, so precisely. So this collision term really has to have a dressed propagator of the gauge field that's producing the scattering. When you do that, I mean, the integrals exist. This makes sense. If you want to calculate that exponential decay rate, all you do is you linearize it. You get some ugly linear integral operator on the right-hand side. And what you literally need is simply its lowest eigenvalue in a particular symmetry sector. That can't be done analytically, but it can certainly be done numerically. Just because it's an offshoot of some other stuff that we think is more interesting, Peter Arnold and I will actually have an answer, a number there, in the not-too-distant future. But the important thing is simply you can do it. You can do it in a relatively straightforward way. We understand the physics that's required to actually calculate that number.
Previously you mentioned that you are not interested in quantities like color conductivity, which are not gauge, they are gauge dependent.
Mm-hmm.
What is your F in this calculation? Is it gauge independent quantity?
Yes, because for this discussion I'm focusing on a globally conserved current. So F here is a distribution function of the excitations in this theory which carry this global charge. All right? So, you know, if I went back to the original scalar field, it has a gauge index and it has a separate, I mean, I can write it as having a separate global charge index. And so, yeah, this is a completely gauge invariant sensible thing. Okay, so one can do that. And one can get an exponential decay, and if you thought that was the end of the story, as I said before, you'd be completely wrong. So, what happened? Well, let me first talk about this qualitatively, and then again talk about what it takes to make a quantitative calculation. So qualitatively, what's important to understand is, to begin with, we have heterodynamic modes, which we've already talked about. In this theory, I have two different types of hydrodynamic modes. I have a conserved charge, and therefore I have charge density fluctuations, now for this global SU2 charge. And just imagine I have some little region of space in which I have an excess of that globally conserved charge. It can't, once again, relax quickly. It can only relax by having excitations physically diffuse out of this region. Right? If this thing is of size L, the time it takes for something to diffuse, just usual random walk, goes like the size of the region squared. If you want to dress that up so it makes sense, it's really the size of the region divided by the, just the characteristic speed with which any excitation moves. In my case, that'll just be the speed of light. And then an overall factor of some characteristic mean-free scattering time. So qualitatively, that's the time with which a fluctuation of some size L can relax. That's true if it's a charge density fluctuation. It's equally true if it's a momentum density or equivalently bulk velocity fluctuation, exactly the same story, same time scale. Right? Of course, if I have a fluctuation like this, it doesn't contribute to the current I'm measuring. If I have a fluctuation like that, it doesn't contribute to the current I'm measuring. But suppose I have this on top of that. Right? Suppose I have a little region of space in which I both have a charge excess and some bulk flow. Now suddenly I have a bulk current. And now I've produced this bulk current in a way that can't possibly relax quickly. It can only relax by having the charge diffuse out and having the momentum density diffuse out. So, when I measure the current-current correlator at some long time t, what happens? Well, if I had fluctuations that looked like this, whose size was small enough, then all these particles would have diffused out and this fluctuation would have disappeared by the time I chose to look at. The longer my time is, though, I will still remain sensitive to the occurrence of fluctuations that look like this, whose size grows as the time I'm interested in grows. Right? Just as I've written here, which is just rewriting that formula. Right? At time little t, I'll be sensitive to fluctuations of this form of this characteristic size L. Well, estimate the total current contained in some little fluctuation of size L. This is just assuming the charges are randomly distributed, velocities are distributed about their mean, and you get a contribution to the current from this little patch of my system that just depends on Q, which is just the charge of each individual excitation, times the typical velocity. That's just one. Right? But then what's the total current? That's what I'm measuring in my correlator. Well, it's the sum of the current in every little patch if I divided my whole system up into patches. And at time t, I've chosen the size of my patches just big enough so that different patches are essentially uncorrelated. That is, there hasn't been time for things to fluctuate from one to another. So I add them as if they're all independent, random little patches. And I guess I won't go through the details, but out of that just comes a factor which is simply the number of patches that I can divide my system into. And that depends on the time at which I'm looking, because that determines the size of my patches. From that alone, you get a factor which looks like the time to the spatial dimension that you're in over two. Okay, so that qualitatively tells you that there must be a long time tail, because you know there must be hydrodynamic fluctuations, and therefore there must be these coincident fluctuations where I have one sort on top of another, and that will give you a long time tail that falls like 1 over t to the 3 halves.
Right.
Yes?
It looks too simple to be wrong, but nonetheless, let me ask this. Are you sure about it? And there's no argument with the power law, but it has a flavor of some other sphere of turbulence, which is gay. I mean, and there's all this argument that
power law may not be quite right there, or maybe a correct direction for country government.
I believe this is really right, but let's talk about that separately.
Can you talk briefly about the candidate market?
Why didn't you say, of course, this is right?
Because I am treating fluctuations in the variables that I've identified as being hydrodynamic modes. That is, charge density fluctuations and momentum density fluctuations,
yes,
as having uncorrelated Gaussian distribution.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Now, justifying that involves saying that I'm only using that when I'm looking at regions that are large, right? This is all applying to large times, much larger than any mean free scattering time. And therefore, justifying that amounts to an application of the central limit theorem. Right? At shorter things, I could have correlations. Things could be very complicated. But I'm really saying we're now just having lots of independent fluctuations on smaller scales going into what I needed, which was just the fluctuations on large scales. So I think that's solid. But to really go through that carefully involves some work.
I sort of said in mind that the quantity tau, the kinetic scale, can be sort of fluctuating quantity. So it's better.
Oh, I should also emphasize one other thing. I am doing three dimensions. If for whatever reason you said what happens in two dimensions, then there are important caveats, which Salman alluded to. Then instead of having a long time tail that's 1 over t to the 3 halves, it's 1 over t. And suddenly you can't Fourier transform anymore, and it really means you literally don't have a hydrodynamic description in the form I'm just about to write down.
Although this argument still goes through a different process.
Mm-hmm. But there, you know, there really is some essentially renormalization group scaling of effective transport scale-dependent transport coefficients, and things are have at least logarithmic corrections. Yeah.
On your very first transference of the subject, you gave the naive argument that the quantity you were considering was fast.
Right.
So now what you're saying is that there's a slow component and a fast component. Is that a way of saying that because this quantity can be constructed by as a sort of a superposition of two hydrodynamic,
yes,
of a conserved density and a velocity,
yes,
there is in fact a slow there's a slow piece,
yes,
to this one,
yes, and there's a thousand cases where you're so used to that you don't even think,
yeah,
about it, you know. I mean, take the Z, it's
but
a resonance.
There is still a fast piece.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So the fast piece is gone, and the slow piece is taking its time to
decay. Right. The only thing I want to emphasize is, as I showed you, that fast piece dominates over a range of time that's only from 1 over g fourth log to 1 over g fourth. And so this is literally, I mean, this is your sort of...
Well, there's also that earlier fact, very fast piece.
Which is totally different physics. That's quantum decoherence. Okay, so I just gave you the hand waving picture, which
and
gives you.
Sorry, so the fast piece is a contribution to J, which has rho equals zero and z equals zero. I'm missing where I've lost where the fast piece is now. You've done too good a job at convincing me the existence of the slow piece. I want to see where the fast piece is.
Oh, fine.
The fast piece has.
Let me.
The slow piece was the piece of J that both rho and d were non-zero.
I guess I want to preserve charge neutrality. Well, all right, here is a schematic picture of a fluctuation in which I have a net current going to the right. Mm-hmm. Right? I've got plus charges moving this way, I've got minus charges that way. Right? Versus here I also have net current to the right, but I have segregated plus charges up here moving to the right and minus charges up there. All right, so that's fast, and this is slow. Okay, so that was the qualitative description. What does it take to actually calculate things? Again, in principle, we could go back to Feynman diagrams, and at this point, I won't even venture a guess what it would what you would have to sum up to do things. We could also, though, just go to our first level of an effective theory, namely the interacting kinetic theory. The error we made was when we linearized. Okay, so don't linearize. Either solve it directly or expand in powers, but keep things through quadratic order. That will work, but that's working too hard. All right, I just lost my slide. Right, no wonder I lost it. All right, if you want to do things as easily as possible, then you want to use the most effective theory you can, and that's now just using hydrodynamics. So let's be efficient. Let's write down a hydrodynamic description. You always do it the same way. That is, the process is the same, even if the details are different. Write down your conservation laws. We now have conservation of T mu nu, which I've just separated into different pieces here. And we have an additional conserved current, whose time component I'm calling rho, and whose spatial part, J, is what I'm interested in measuring. And now you write down constitutive relations, which tell you how the stresses, the currents, are related to derivatives of the conserved quantities themselves. All right, so here you have the same pieces that I showed before, stuff that involves bulk viscosity, a shear viscosity term I didn't write down. Here's the constitutive relation for the conserved charge density that says the current looks like depends on the gradient of the charge density. And once again, if I say I'm looking at very small deviations from equilibrium, if I linearize, then I immediately have nothing interesting. That is, if I use a hydrodynamic description and I think that it's good enough to linearize things, then I don't see anything about relaxation of my current at all. What I have to do is keep the nonlinear terms, which was apparent there in the hand-waving qualitative discussion. And so you need the next terms. And if you think about all possible terms consistent with the symmetries, as usual, you realize you can have a term which looks like charge density times bulk velocity. And if this is really a continuum theory, Galilean invariance tells you the coefficient is 1. That's a long-winded way of saying that you know there's a contribution that goes like rho v. But you could think about it as just sort of a systematic construction of an effective theory. And therefore, what happens? If you have, the more hydrodynamic modes, the more complicated things get. But it's also true that things are simpler in a relativistic setting where T mu nu is a symmetric tensor and you don't have to distinguish, momentum density from energy flux. So it is actually simpler than a lot of textbook treatments for non-relativistic systems. Okay.
Eij, why does it not include delta ij divergence of j?
J is not a hydrodynamic variable. Our only hydrodynamic variables are charge density rho and momentum density, which is equivalent to saying bulk velocity v, and energy density. I mean, beyond the ones we've already identified, I'm looking at high temperature. There's no spontaneous symmetry breaking.
You're right.
You know, and, you know, if you have spontaneous symmetry breaking of a continuous variable, necessarily you have new hydrodynamic degrees of freedom. All right. But I wanted to make things as simple as I could. That's also why I focused on the zero momentum component, which means from this constitutive relation, this term just drops out altogether. All I have is rho times v. And so my correlator is really, in a hydrodynamic description, just this. And again, this will factorize for the same reasons I sketched a moment ago. These are conserved currents. Conserved currents never get anomalous dimensions. All right, so basically you just calculate this. You say you have fluctuations in charge density, which you know about because that's equilibrium information. That is, you know what they are at time, at equal time, but you also know what their time dependence is because they're hydrodynamic modes. They have to relax on a time scale that gets slower and slower as their wavelength gets longer and longer. That's to say the charge density correlation relaxes with e to the minus some number times k squared t. Well, what that number is just the charge diffusion constant. And similarly, the velocity correlator has a similar exponential decay where what its constant is, well, there's really two pieces, one that depends on the bulk viscosity and one that depends on the shear. I just wrote part of the contribution here. But you literally take what you already know about the relaxation of the hydrodynamic modes and just plug it in. And the only thing is, since we have correlated fluctuations of charge density and momentum density, in the end that turns into integrating over k. And so all you're doing is you have something which had Gaussian relaxation, but with an exponent that had a factor of k squared, and now you're just integrating over k. You do the Gaussian integral, out pops the 1 over t to the 3 halves power law with the numbers in front, which are completely calculable. Okay. That is my penultimate slide. I've been bouncing around from various topics, calculating transport coefficients, topological transition rates, here current correlators. At least in my mind, there are connections between all of these applications, which all involve thinking about what is the correct effective description of some real-time dynamics. How do you really construct it in a controlled fashion? What's its real domain of validity? And just to contrast, if we were interested in equilibrium physics, we know a vast amount of stuff. I mean, in essence, any question involving equilibrium, even if I can't spell it right, correlators, you know, you write as some Euclidean theory. The fundamental theory is just some Euclidean quantum field theory, yeah, defined on a periodic four-dimensional space. If I want to think about long-distance physics, the natural effective theory is still a Euclidean quantum field theory, perhaps dimensionally reduced. I can actually have a whole sequence of effective theories as I integrate out more and more degrees of freedom, but in every case, some notion of the appropriate renormalization group is just mapping a Euclidean quantum field theory to another Euclidean quantum field theory. That's why you can set it up as some sort of continuous transformation. In contrast, for all these real-time problems I've talked about, I think it's indisputable that while your fundamental theory is now a quantum field theory, a real, so to speak, Minkowski space quantum field theory, but at finite temperature because we're asking real-time questions, the natural, useful sort of effective theories are undeniably things like kinetic theory and its domain of validity. In theories which have very low-frequency modes that almost behave classically, like the discussion of non-abelian gauge theories and topological transitions we're going to hear more about, the natural effective theory is some sort of classical but stochastic theory, with the stochastic bit reflecting the remnant of the interaction of the low frequency modes with all the high frequency modes that you're trying to ignore. If we're truly interested in long time behavior, then necessarily it's hydrodynamics. Perhaps complicated hydrodynamics if you have charge fluctuations, if you have spontaneously broken symmetries, but still some form of hydrodynamics. And in order to really use these effective theories quantitatively, you've got to be able to construct them, you've got to be able to systematically match them. I've shown you essentially all the cases where I know how to do that to leading order in a weakly coupled theory. In every one of these applications, you could have asked, what if you're interested in corrections suppressed by a power of the coupling? That's a hard problem. It's not hard technically, it's hard physically. Because, for example, the validity of kinetic theory, you always have to say that you're treating your excitations as they propagate between collisions as if they're effectively little classical particles. That is, they're on shell. Right? You can rephrase this back in terms of Feynman diagrams. You did some loop integral and you approximated it by just taking its contribution from the residue of a quasi-particle pole. You made an error. The error physically has to do with how big the uncertainty in, say, the energy of the particle is as it's propagating between collisions. I mean, if it's only propagating for finite time, obviously there's a quantum uncertainty. The size of that error is only suppressed by a power of coupling. So thinking about subleading corrections, it's not just sufficient to use better scattering amplitudes in the collision term you write down. It really makes you think about the very fundamental justification of your kinetic description. I don't know how to do that. That's, I think, a very important, interesting problem. And, well, at least in analogy with what we know in equilibrium things, it would be wonderful if there was some notion of a Wilsonian renormalization group where you could just integrate out a little bit. But it's now a much more puzzling thing. How do I integrate out a little bit and go from a quantum field theory to kinetic theory, or go from kinetic theory to hydrodynamics? I think that's another very puzzling but interesting problem, which might have some nice solutions. I'll stop there.